During the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump's comments on transatlantic relations signaled a possible rupture with decades of U.S. policy. Trump, as candidate and then president-elect, praised the U.K.'s plans to exit the European Union and vowed to scrap an EU-U.S. trade deal. He also called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization obsolete, while at times praising Russian President Vladimir Putin's leadership. In February of this year, Vice President Mike Pence spent some time in Europe allaying concerns about U.S. intentions. He assured European allies that the United States would remain committed to supporting the EU and its security through NATO. Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, had this to say about his meeting with the vice president.
I asked the vice president directly if he shared my opinions on three key matters: international order, security, and the attitude of the new American administration towards the European Union. In reply to these three matters, I heard today from Vice President Pence three times yes. After such a positive declaration, both Europeans and Americans must simply practice what they preach.
I'm Robert McMahon, managing editor of CFR.org, and you're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox and discuss what he has said he will do and what constraints he might face. This week, we're going to talk about the United States' relationship with Europe and how President Trump will handle it. We're fortunate this week to have with us Charles Kupchan, CFR's senior fellow with expertise in transatlantic relations, European politics, and NATO. Previously, Charlie served as special assistant to the president and senior director for European affairs on the staff of the National Security Council in the Obama administration. He heads up a CFR roundtable on European studies, teaches at Georgetown University, and is the author of No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Bob.
Charlie, I'm going to start out with some basics because I think some assumptions about the U.S.-EU relationship are being severely challenged. So with that being said, could you sketch out for us a bit the extent of the U.S.-EU trade relationship, the economic ties, and then we'll kind of walk through the security linkages as well?
Well, the European Union is the world's largest market. The United States, also a very large market. And the trade ties and the commercial ties across the Atlantic are some of the thickest and richest that exist in the world. The U.S. most important trading partners are those right next door in Canada and Mexico, but the flows of commerce, goods, services, people across the Atlantic is huge. And the number of jobs that European investment cause here, the number of jobs that American investment lead to in Europe, very, very significant additions to employment and to GDP on both sides of the Atlantic. So it is a very close and balanced economic relationship that works for both sides.
The U.S. has traditionally supported the whole EU project really from the get-go. Can you talk about a bit of the basics of why that is the case and trace it to today?
The most important element in the U.S. relationship with Europe is that Europe is the anchor of our global policy. And this goes back to really World War I, but it was confirmed at the close of World War II when the United States helped lock in a democratic Europe through NATO and through the project of European integration, which we supported and assisted through the Marshall Plan and other efforts to help integrate Europe. For example, its initial form was the coal and steel community that was forged mainly between France and Germany. We were very supportive of that effort. And all the while, over the last few decades, the project of European integration has deepened, both as an economic project but also a political project, bringing down the importance of borders, creating a European identity. And writ large, we now have a world in which the Atlantic democracies are really the core providers of an international order that's based upon rules and based upon law. The world, unfortunately, hasn't changed as much as one might hope. That is to say, 25 years or so after the end of the Cold War, one would have hoped that the U.S. could go fashion strong partnerships with China, and India and Brazil and Indonesia and Turkey and other powers that are on the upswing, that simply hasn't happened, in part because those powers are not ready to be providers of what we'd call public goods. Are they sending troops on peacekeeping missions? Are they helping us fight Ebola? Are they leaning in on questions of climate change? Generally, the answer is not as much as we would like. And so the bottom line is that when there's a problem out there and we need help in the world, we still call Europe.
So I want to walk back to your term integration here, because I think this is the one of these first principles that's coming up again all of a sudden as something under challenge perhaps with the new U.S. administration. Integration was seen, was very much promoted on the U.S. side because in the post-war context as well as in the Cold War context, this made a Europe that was going to be less at war with itself, as well as something that would be more effective in countering the Soviet expansion. Is that, you know, in a nutshell, is that close?
Yeah, I mean, the I would put it this way. It was a project of economic integration in the service of geopolitics. That is to say that on any given day, if you went to Europe and said, well, what's going on? The answer is they're trading more. They're creating a single market so that whatever you build or make in Germany, you can sell it in France and you can sell it in the Netherlands, and it's all the same standard, and we all have the same rules about, for example, testing medicine. But behind this integration on an economic basis was the goal of creating a Europe that was at peace, because European history up until 1949, when this project began, or early 1950s, was a history of bloodshed, with the French going after the Germans and the Brits going after the French. And, you know, I could continue ad nauseum going back in history. And really, for the first time in European history, at the close of World War II, a project of peace building was launched. That project has been remarkably successful. You now drive from France to Germany along a border that for many, 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 many centuries was riddled with dead bodies. You don't see a border guard. You don't change money. You don't see a tank. You basically will see some sheep in a pasture, and you just keep going. And that is one of the great geopolitical revolutions of our time. Now, because of the rise of populism, because of immigration, because of a backlash against globalization, the nation state is coming back to life. So much so that in the case of the United Kingdom, they held a referendum in favor of leaving this project. Now you have upcoming elections in the Netherlands, in France, in Germany, maybe in Italy, that could bring to power other populist parties that are interested in backing away from this project of integration. The stakes could not be larger.
So let's talk about the stakes. Why does it matter on this side of the Atlantic, the Americans and you're listening about and hearing about European concerns recently voiced, as we heard, by Donald Tusk? Why does it matter to the U.S. On a broader basis?
Well, I think the most important part of the puzzle here is what we've been talking about. That is, our main partner in the world is Europe. And it is a collective Europe, even though Europe is not a federal state. There is Brussels. There is an effort to act as a unitary player when it comes to sanctions against Russia, when it comes to dealing with terrorism and sharing intelligence and sharing law enforcement efforts. Do they have a long way to go on those fronts? Do they, for example, have a European army? Have they pooled sovereignty on defense? No, they have not. But individual European nations are in this world of China and India. They're too small to really be players. So if the European Union unravels and we are just left with a Europe of nation states, we lose the aggregate power of the EU. And under the worst case scenario, we lose a Europe that is at peace. We may again go back to a situation in which national boundaries come back to life, and in which that overriding assumption that has guided us as a post-war power, that is to say that Europe is at peace, Europe is our partner, that could gradually come undone. Not to mention the hit that we would take on the economic front and probably the pulling down of free trade, because in general, a lot of these parties are against free trade, against a single currency for Europe, and we'd be looking at a Europe of a very different political complexion.
You mentioned the sanctions against Russia. Let's talk about Russia a little bit more. To what extent does Russia pose a threat? Is it overblown? Is it real in terms of this project of a united Europe, as well as one not overrun by populism and nationalism?
Well, I think Russia poses a threat on multiple dimensions. There is the traditional dimension, and in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, its illegal annexation of Crimea, its military presence, continuing military presence in eastern Ukraine, we now have to be worried about a Russia that is willing to use force to overturn Europe's territorial status quo. That is a threat of a sort that we haven't seen since the Soviet Union fell apart. And it's precisely why NATO over the last few years has been taking steps to bolster its capability on the eastern flank, Poland in particular, but also the three Baltic states. There is also a threat that's being posed by Russia's political interference. In some cases, it's explicit, as we saw here in the United States, where there was hacking, there was release of emails as a way to influence the outcome of our election. In some case, it is what you might call more background, that is to say, Russian TV in the form of Russia Today and Sputnik, social media, websites, NGOs, they are very present across Europe in an effort to fuel populism, in an effort to degrade the European Union, precisely because they want to disrupt this liberal international system that Americans and Europeans together have built. They think that that system works to the disadvantage of Russia. The other thing that I think is important to stress is that our ability to deter Russia depends heavily on Atlantic solidarity. I think Putin has been shocked that the U.S. and EU stayed together on sanctions and on Russia policy in general. I think he's shocked that he was unable to peel off the Greeks, the Hungarians, the Slovaks, and others, and that he has faced an EU that is unified in standing up to Russia and imposing sanctions. We need to keep that solidarity intact, because if Russia is able to pull the EU and the U.S. apart, if he's able to get inside the EU and crack it, it's going to be much, much harder for us to deal with an aggressive Russia.
So the Trump administration comes to office with some new language, obviously, about how it views the NATO alliance, how it views the EU, and also how it views Russia. It's continuing to say it wants to keep its cards on the table, various cards on the table for how to deal with Russia. But it also is seeming to acknowledge that there are many, many facets to this relationship. What are the areas of biggest challenge in Russia? Is it the Ukrainian front? Is it the sort of multifaceted Russian role in what's known as disinformatia?
You know, I think that in some ways the most dangerous aspect of Russian foreign policy right now is the degree to which they are attempting to weaken the West internally. I think we can deal with Ukraine. We can deal with Syria. We can put more troops along NATO's eastern frontier if we need to. What we're not as good at and what we are less well prepared to do is deal with the propaganda. Deal with a Russian state that controls the media and therefore has a leg up when it comes to getting its message out. So I think the first order of business is finding out how to counter Russia's presence in our societies, to do a better job of broadcasting to Russian speakers in Russia, in Ukraine, in the Baltics, because generally they're getting fed one line and it's coming out of the Kremlin. We need to make sure that there are alternative voices. And we need to think long and hard about how to deal with this question of the penetration of our emails, our servers from Russia, the hacking that's gone on. Maybe we need to be more aggressive in retaliating. Maybe we need to be prepared to escalate to deter. This is uncharted territory. So I think it's the area where we in the United States and Western Europe need to do the most thinking in terms of an effective policy response.
The message that was brought to the Europeans in recent four, especially the Munich Security Conference, from high-level U.S. officials was assurance, we're there, we are committed to the alliance, and so forth. It was also a consistent message of, but on, in terms of burden sharing, there's this problem, and there's this problem of countries not paying their fair share. Is that getting, and do you see that getting any more traction in terms of countries, especially, say, the bigger economies in Europe, signing up to this 2% level of GDP that's been mentioned repeatedly? That was promised at the Wales conference.
Yeah. I mean, I think that on Europe policy in general, we don't yet know what to expect from the Trump administration, because the president says ABC, and then the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and the Vice President say XYZ. And XYZ, that is to say, we still stand by Europe, we stand by NATO, we're going to be tough on Russia. Those are things that the Europeans like to hear. They now want to know what our policy is, whether some of the things that the president said as a candidate in early days in office are going to hold true, or whether, in fact, we're going to be more conventional in our approach. So work in progress, stay tuned. On the specific issue of NATO spending more on defense, here I think President Trump is sending an important message, and it's not a new message. He's saying that we need our allies to do more to shoulder their fair share of the defense burden. The U.S. spends about 3.5% of GDP on defense. The NATO target is 2%. There are only five countries, including the United States, that are hitting that 2% target. And so this was something that the Obama administration was very focused on. The president spent a lot of time in the lead up to the Wales summit in 2014 working the phones, saying, I need you to commit to this. And in the end, they committed. Now the question is, will they implement? The only difference, I think, between what President Trump has said and what others have said is Trump has said it with a bit of a threat, which is, you know, if you don't spend more money, if you don't contribute to the kitty, who knows whether we're going to defend you? That's rattled a lot of cages. Before, it was more persuasion and nudging people along. You need to stand by your commitment to 2%. Now, it may be that more threatening posture lights a fire under the leaders to make the grade. We will see.
One of the issues that Trump, the candidate, and Trump as president has sounded repeatedly vis-a-vis the European relationship, the NATO relationship, is the degree to which they're effective on fighting terrorism, counterterrorism. He had negative remarks about NATO's role in fighting terrorism initially. He had also talked about Russia being a potentially important partner in countering terrorism, including in places like Syria. Could you talk a little bit about what you saw the reality of, to the extent you can, the way the U.S. and Europeans have worked together or not in countering terrorism across various strands of issues, whether it's intelligence sharing or actually on the ground activities?
You know, I think the most important progress that we've made is on intel sharing, both across the Atlantic, but also getting the Europeans themselves to bring down some of the barriers to sharing information about foreign fighters, to sharing information about air traffic passengers, to getting more cooperation between Turkey and the U.S. and Turkey and Europe, because we know that a lot of foreign fighters go into and out of Syria through Turkey. Not so much anymore, but they used to. But so we had to keep a very vigilant eye on the flow of folks through airports and other transportation hubs. So that's where I think the most progress has been made. The second, I would point out that NATO is now in the counterterrorism game. And I think that we worked hard in the Obama administration on developing what you would call a southern strategy for NATO to go along with the eastern strategy. The eastern strategy is the traditional, let's stand up to Russia. The south was about getting NATO involved in the counter-ISIL mission, and it now is through participation of NATO AWACS and NATO is standing up a training mission in Iraq to help train the Iraqi army in the fight against ISIL. We also got NATO involved in the counter-migration game, initially in the Aegean to help stem the flow of refugees from Turkey to Greece. And now NATO is backstopping the EU to try to resolve the flow problems that we see from Libya, Central Med, over to Italy. So there are two examples in which we're seeing NATO get in the game. I think the president is right that we need NATO to do more on this front. On the question of cooperation with Russia, I have to say I'm puzzled by President Trump's happy talk about Russia, because Russia right now is, in my mind, as threatening as it's been at any time since the end of the Cold War, and arguably more threatening during the Cold War, because now there's this added layer of penetration of our societies. And the one sort of bracket or qualification would be that Syria offers an opportunity for cooperation against ISIL and against terrorists in general. We worked very hard to try to cooperate with Russia. We ended up only engaging in what one would call deconfliction, that is to make sure that Russian aircraft and U.S. aircraft didn't get in one another's way in carrying out missions in Syrian airspace. Now that the situation on the ground has changed, that Aleppo has fallen, that Turkey is cooperating with Russia rather than against Russia, I think we need to take another look at whether there are opportunities for the United States and its coalition partners to cooperate more with Russia to bring an end to the long-running conflict in Syria.
Let's talk about Turkey a little bit in terms of the challenges, the sort of unique challenges it poses as both a NATO member as well as its ongoing relationship with the EU, which is fraught but also crucial, especially in the refugee space. Turkey is going through its own, we could say many things, but we could certainly call it, I would say, a bout of populism, perhaps. Could you talk about the challenges Turkey poses to the transatlantic relationship as well?
Well, Turkey is, as you put it, going through a bumpy patch, and it's hard to think about a country that lives in a less desirable neighborhood. It's got Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, all around it, and none of those countries are countries that you would want to be your neighbor. And so I think, we have to...
But it used to tout a good neighbor policy that it was espousing.
Yes, it did tout that. That policy didn't go so well. And now the Turks face real trouble on mostly their southern border, but their relationship with the European Union has become strained. That was sort of on a course toward accession talks and possible membership. That seems to be off the table for now. The government was threatened by a coup last summer. In the wake of that coup, there has been a huge crackdown against those that were suspected of being, quote-unquote, Gulenists, part of a movement that the government sees as having been behind the coup, as well as others that oppose Erdogan. And there is a fight going on with the country's Kurds, many of whom are in northern Iraq, carrying out terrorist attacks across the border inside Turkey. So the country is really under great strain. To add to that, we have a problem with Turkey when it comes to Syria, in the sense that our long-term objectives are the same, and that is to defeat ISIL and to clear the way for a political transition in which Assad leaves power. To prosecute the counter-ISIL war, however, the U.S. has been cooperating with Syrian Kurds, who are what you might call sisters and brothers of the PKK, the terrorist organization that's based in northern Iraq and that carries out attacks in Turkey. So the Turks are very uncomfortable with the fact that we rely on the Kurds. The problem is the Kurds are the best fighters that exist in Syria. And so we have just been trying to balance between our commitments to Turkey and our alliance with Turkey, as well as the need to prosecute the war against ISIL. And right now, I think the Trump administration is grappling with how to get that balance right.
Now, one of the areas of obvious alignment over the years between the United States and the EU were, I guess I would put it in the broader context of values, human rights, you know, democracy promotion. These countries worked together on lots of these areas. We saw it in the post-1989 phase after the Berlin Wall fell in terms of, the expansion of both NATO and the EU, but also expansion of values. And these values now seem to be under threat because of what you referred to previously, which is the resurgence of populism and nationalism and concerns about really overwhelming numbers of migrants coming in, many of them Muslim, a sort of a civilizational threat going on. It's the United States. This is a big debate raging here as well. How do you see the Europeans and the United States talking to each other about these common problems? Is it a concern that they are just going to, that these might devolve into just nation state issues and not sort of areas where the two big blocks could talk to each other?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that both sides of the Atlantic are going through this populist wave says that we have a systemic problem, that it's not just Brexit. It's not just a Polish government that's veering off to the right. And so I do think that we need to have a common conversation, and it has to start with the question of what our populations and our working classes in particular are going to do to earn a living wage in the year 2025. We haven't answered that question yet. And it's precisely because we haven't answered that question that we are facing with a revolt of sorts among our electorates that want to turn the system upside down. I think to address this issue, we do have to get to the heart of the problem, and that is a combination of automation and globalization and free trade. It bears some of the responsibility. Has led to a situation where most manufacturing sectors of the country, and this, you could say the same of Italy or the same of the UK, they've seen a real downturn in their fortunes, factories closing, wages taking a nosedive. So we need to just figure out how to deal with that. I don't think the answer is protectionism. In fact, my guess is that will make matters worse because it will drive up consumer prices. And in the end of the day, we're not going back to the 1950s when we had an economy powered by manufacturing. There's too much water under the bridge. So we have to have a conversation about investments, education, vocational training, tax policy, fiscal policy to get at this question. And that's where I think the conversation should start. The second big piece of this is immigration, because there's no question that on both sides of the Atlantic, the question of immigration is fueling the populist backlash. I would say it's a tougher conversation in Europe. Number one, because Europe is not an immigrant nation or it comprised of immigrant nations in the same way the U.S. is, and because the influx there is largely Muslim. And that raises the whole question of, are these minorities being integrated? Are they a source of terrorism in a way that we don't really have, given that most of our immigrants are coming from Central America? I'd say those are the two pieces of the puzzle over which we need a transatlantic conversation.
And on that note of conversation, we will close up the President's Inbox for this week. Charlie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Bob.
Please subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed on The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick, recording engineer John Fletcher, and special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on The President's Inbox.